Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm General Mike Myatt, President and CEO of the Marines Memorial Association, and your moderator for tonight's program. Tonight's program is being held in association with the Marines Memorial. For information on the Commonwealth Club, please visit the website commonwealthclub.org, and for information on the Marines Memorial, it's at marineclub.com. And now it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished speaker, Evan Thomas. Evan Thomas is Newsweek's editor-at-large and author of a new book, The War Lovers, Roosevelt, Lodge, Hearst, and the Rush to Empire, 1898. Evan Thomas was made editor-at-large of Newsweek in September 2006. He's the magazine's lead writer on major news stories and the author of many longer features, including Newsweek's special behind-the-scenes issues on presidential elections, and more than 100 cover stories. He's written 7 books, all history books, with several becoming New York Times bestsellers. In addition to writing, he teaches at Princeton at the Ferris Professor of Journalism. He's a graduate of Harvard and the University of Virginia Law School. He lives in Washington, D.C. with his wife and 2 children, and his wife's here tonight for the program. Please join me in welcoming Evan Thomas.
Thank you, General. I'm delighted to be in San Francisco and at the Commonwealth Club, the most beautiful city in America, I think, every time I come here. Mrs. Theodore Roosevelt, Edith Roosevelt, was a loving and tender wife, but she also knew when to take her Theodore down a few pegs. And a couple of years after the famous Battle of San Juan Hill, when Theodore Roosevelt had charged up on her horse, she went to Cuba. And when she came back, she teased her husband that she'd been to San Juan Hill, and it wasn't that big a hill, it was kind of a little hill. A couple of years ago, I went to Santiago and stood at the bottom of that hill, and it looked pretty tall to me if somebody's up at the top shooting down at you. July 1st, 1898 was the day that Theodore Roosevelt always said was the most important in his life. He called it his crowded hour. He got up around 4 a.m. and he was already dressed. He slept in his cavalryman's uniform, specially ordered from Brooks Brothers. And he tied a blue bandana on the back of his hat to keep the sun off his neck, but also to be noticed. Like a lot of great men, he was careful to keep a reporter close by, the most famous reporter of his day, Richard Harding Davis, who recorded what it looked like when Roosevelt bounded up that hill on his horse. Davis wrote, "No one who saw Roosevelt take that ride expected him to finish it alive. He was the only man on a horse, a huge target well ahead of his troops." Roosevelt made it to the top of the hill, rested for a minute, went off down the other side with about 5 men. 2 of them were shot. Roosevelt shouted out, "Holy Godfrey, what fun!" When he got to the top of the hill, he took out his Colt 38 and he shot a Spanish soldier. That night, he took out his little pocket diary, and he wrote 4 lines. "Rose at 4, big battle, commanded regiment, held extreme front of firing line." A couple of days later, he wrote to his friend Henry Cabot Lodge, "Did I tell you that I killed a Spaniard with my own hand?" Roosevelt was a true war lover. In 1886, when he was a 27-year-old gentleman rancher in the Dakotas, he proposed raising, quote, some companies of horse riflemen out here in the event of trouble with Mexico, first hint of the Rough Riders. He wrote his friend Henry Cabot Lodge, who was a congressman back in Washington, "Will you telegraph me at once if war becomes inevitable?" In 1889, while agitating for military preparedness, he wrote British diplomat Cecil Spring Rice, "Frankly, I don't know if I should be sorry to see a bit of a spar with Germany. The burning of New York and a few other seacoast cities would be a good object lesson on the need of an adequate system of coastal defenses." Roosevelt loved hyperbole, but he was apparently serious. He wrote Spring Rice, "While we would have to take some awful blows at first, I think in the end we would worry the Kaiser a little." A few years later, in 1894, he wrote a family friend, Bob Ferguson, that he longed for, quote, "a general national buccaneering expedition to drive the Spanish out of Cuba, the English out of Canada." Roosevelt wanted a war, and almost any war, against Mexico or Germany or Britain or Spain would do. In 1897, he gave a famous speech at the Naval War College, which he said, "All the great masterful races have been fighting races. No triumph of peace is quite so great as the supreme triumphs of war." Some wars are noble and certainly necessary. World War II was necessary. The Spanish-American War was a war of choice, and in 1898, America was eager to go to war. President McKinley called for 125,000 volunteers, immediately got 1 million men. The war did some good. We liberated Cuba, which had been repressed by the Spaniards for a long time. And in the beginning, at least, it seemed like a splendid little war, as the diplomat John Hay called it. But we got caught in a counterinsurgency war in the Philippines almost by mistake. We had sent a fleet out there. Teddy Roosevelt, actually, as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, had sent a fleet out there to conquer the Spanish fleet, Dewey at Manila. But the next thing you knew, we were occupying the Philippines, and the people there revolted against us. A counterinsurgency broke out that lasted 4 years and cost 4,000 men, roughly the same number we've lost in Iraq. I became fascinated with the phenomenon of war fever when I was writing for Newsweek in 2003. By about 2006, I was beginning to think a lot about what is it that gets countries caught up in war? What makes war fevers break out? And I decided to go back in time, go back a century, and look at five characters in 1898. Roosevelt, his best friend Henry Cabot Lodge, who was really America's first imperialist. They didn't use that word. That was a European word. Lodge preferred to talk about the large policy. But it was this idea that America had conquered its frontiers, needed to expand, needed to be a global power. The model was Great Britain. We needed to be a great sea power, and we needed to have possessions to do that. And he and Lodge and Roosevelt sort of worked together as a duo to try to bring this about. My third hawk was William Randolph Hearst, initially of San Francisco, who developed a theory of journalism here for the San Francisco Examiner that became known as crime and underwear journalism. Worked very well to sell newspapers, but nothing sells newspapers quite like war. And Hearst did his best to get us into a war. He boasted that when the war of 1898 broke out, he called it the Journal's War, after his own newspaper. And when that war came about, he went there himself. He took 20 correspondents, 12 yachts, a giant hot air balloon, a printing press, the first ever motion picture camera to film a war, and two New York showgirls whom he dressed in sailor suits. He was there when Roosevelt was getting up that morning. He was a mile away, he dressed himself. He put on a scarlet tie to match his scarlet hat band, and he stuck a pistol in his belt, and he went out. He had a servant with a picnic lunch. He went to the wrong place and missed the battle. But 3 days later, he was on his yacht following the naval battle of Santiago, and when a Spanish ship was sunk, he went on shore and personally, with his pistol, captured 29 Spanish sailors. whom he required to give three cheers for George Washington and Old Glory. I also wrote about two very interesting doves on the other side, the philosopher William James, who was kind of a Greek chorus in my book. James understood the pull of war, the lure of war, the seductive quality of war, but also warned against it. He gave a speech that fascinated me. There was a great warrior in the Civil War, Robert Gould Shaw, who has a memorial at the top of Beacon Hill in Boston. You may have seen this story in the movie Glory, a wonderful movie. If you haven't seen Glory, go see it. Well, that's the story of Shaw, and they made a memorial to him. Well, James gave a speech at the dedication in 1897 in which he said, we're here to celebrate Shaw's courage, but, you know, really, courage in war is, there's a lot of it through the ages. That's not unique. What was unique about Shaw was that he left his troop of fancy Harvard boys and went over to command a Negro regiment that had been neglected and spat upon, that showed not martial courage but civic courage, and that's what he wanted to celebrate. The speech actually didn't go over that well. There was sort of polite applause, and James wrote his brother saying, I think it was kind of a dud, but it's a speech, it's a memorable speech, and it resonates, I think, today. My other dove was Thomas Brackett Reed, a figure who's been lost to history altogether. He was Speaker of the House, known as Czar Reed in his days, because he was so powerful. He was really a very powerful figure. Reed, interestingly, was best friends with Lodge and Roosevelt, but they broke over the war. Reed just could not understand why we were going off to war in Cuba when we had a lot of problems at home to deal with. Reed was immune from war fever, and although he was a very powerful figure, he could not stop it. Literally a riot broke out on the floor of the House of Representatives when they were passing the war resolution. There were fist fights. People stopped to sing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Reed had to order the Sergeant of Arms down with a silver mace to try to break up the fights, but he was rolled over by this fever and quit Congress and died, I think, of a broken heart a couple of years later. All of these characters are fascinating men. But I want to speak just for a minute or two about Roosevelt, who my New York Times book reviewer said tends to suck all the oxygen out of the room, and he does. There's a famous photograph picturing Lincoln's casket entering Washington Square in New York City in April 1865. And in the photograph, you can see down in the corner a very large mansion that was owned by Roosevelt's grandfather, Cornelius. And in one of the windows, you can see two little tiny heads of the photographs in the book. One of those heads belongs to Teddy Roosevelt, age 6, and the other is his brother, Elliot. And they're watching the casket, but what they're really watching, what Roosevelt's really watching, are the soldiers marching behind the so-called Invalid Brigade. These were Civil War soldiers who had been badly wounded, many of them missing a limb. Teddy Roosevelt was just obsessed with wounded soldiers. As a little boy, he would wrap himself up in rags to pretend to be a bandaged soldier. And even as an older man, he wrote, "I have always been unhappy, most unhappy, that I was not severely wounded in some striking and disfiguring way." According to family lore, Roosevelt was ashamed in some way of his father, who was an otherwise wonderful figure, but who brought a draft substitute in the Civil War. This was not uncommon in New York upper classes. Typically, they bought draft substitutes, but this was a source of shame to Roosevelt, at least according to his daughter, who gave this psycho theory many years later, but has some resonance. Whatever motivated him, Roosevelt, all through his life, was absolutely obsessed, is not too strong a word, with testing himself physically, with exposing himself to physical danger. When his first wife Alice died, he almost never spoke of her again. Instead, he went west to hunt big game, and he wrote, "Black care rarely sits behind a rider whose pace is fast enough." In his book, Hunting Trips, Roosevelt rated the challenges of hunting by degrees of peril to the hunter, with lesser animals than panthers, than grizzlies. Well, of course, the most dangerous game is man. And Roosevelt had tracked some horse thieves, but he'd never really had a chance to hunt men or to fight them. He had missed that essential test of combat. He was 39 years old when the Spanish-American War broke out, a war that he had done his best to foment. He had four children. His wife had almost died in childbirth and was still very sick. His oldest son, Theodore Jr., had a nervous collapse. Can you imagine being Theodore Roosevelt Jr.? And yet Roosevelt just had to go. Some years later, he wrote his military attaché, Archie Butts, "When the chance came for me to go to Cuba with the Rough Riders, Mrs. Roosevelt was very ill, and so was Teddy. It was a question if either would ultimately get well. You know what my wife and children mean to me, and yet I made up my mind that I would not allow even a death to stand in my way, that it was my one chance to do something for my country and for my family, and my one chance to cut my little notch on the stick that stands as a measuring rod in every family. I know now that I would have turned from my wife's deathbed to answer that call." At the time that Roosevelt enlisted in the Rough Riders, his boss, John Long, the Secretary of the Navy, made an entry in his diary. These were the days when cabinet officials could write in literary ways, and I'm just going to read you this paragraph out of Long's diary. He's writing about Roosevelt. "He has lost his head in this unutterable folly of deserting his post where he is of most service and running off to ride a horse and probably brush mosquitoes from his neck in the Florida sands. His heart is right, and he means well, but it is one of these cases of aberration, desertion, vainglory, of which he is utterly unaware. He thinks he is following his highest ideal, whereas, in fact, as without exception, every one of his friends advises him he is acting like a fool. And yet, how absurd all this will sound if, by some turn of fortune, he should accomplish some great thing and strike a very high mark." Well, on that page, which is the Massachusetts Historical Society, in a little pencil notation at the bottom, it says, "Later, P.S., Roosevelt was right, and we, his friends, were all wrong. His going into the Army led straight to the presidency." The war seems to have lifted some kind of burden from Roosevelt. It's almost as if he got something out of his system when he rode up that hill and shot that Spaniard. He, as a president, he was not a notably bellicose president. He liked to say, "talk softly but carry a big stick," but he never used that stick. If anything, he kept America out of war. He won a Nobel Peace Prize for settling a war between Japan and Russia. He was a fairly cautious, moderate president. But after he left the White House, the fever seemed to come back. He tried to get himself killed by going on a famous expedition up the Amazon. And then when World War I came and was on the eve of World War I breaking out, he went to President Wilson and offered or asked if he could raise a division to fight in France. And Wilson was smart enough to turn him down, not wanting to make a martyr out of him or an even bigger hero than he already was, and thus a political opponent. And as Roosevelt was leaving the White House, he said to Colonel E.M. House, who was Wilson's top aide, Roosevelt said, "I don't understand. After all, I'm only asking to die." House, who was fed up with Roosevelt by this time, paused and replied, "Oh, did you make that point quite clear to the president?" Unable to go himself, Roosevelt wanted all of his four sons to serve. It was a generational thing. Each generation should have this chance to test themselves. And each Roosevelt did serve. They were all saw a lot of action. Three of them were wounded. When the first, Archie, was wounded in France, the Roosevelts were having dinner at Sagamore Hill, and they rose and threw their wine glasses into the fireplace. The first Roosevelt had been blooded, as they put it. But then, in July 1918, the youngest Roosevelt son, Quentin, was shot down and killed in a dogfight over France. And the Roosevelt somehow recovered the axle of the plane, a bent black piece of iron which they hung over the mantelpiece at Sagamore Hill. It hangs there today. And for days thereafter, Roosevelt sat in that room pretending to read a book and murmuring his youngest son's childhood nickname, Quenty Quenty. The romance of war, at long last, had given way to heartbreak. Roosevelt, who was not yet 60 years old, was dead within 6 months. War will always be with us, and there are times when we will have to fight, hopefully as bravely as all you Marines in the room and as all those Roosevelts did. Ted Jr., that neurotic little boy that I mentioned earlier, he was the only general officer to land in the first wave at D-Day, Normandy, Utah Beach. They landed him in the wrong place, and he famously said, "Well, the war starts here." And then he led an attack on a German position using a cane. He was in his late 50s with a heart condition, and he was dead within a month. He won the Medal of Honor, which is a medal that eluded his father, despite a lot of lobbying, in his own lifetime. So it goes, generation after generation. Let me just end with a couple of thoughts I ran into while I was researching this book. One is from Paul Fussell, author of a wonderful book called The Great War in Modern Memory. Fussell wrote, "Every war is ironic because every war is worse than expected." The other is from Robert E. Lee, "It is well that war is so terrible, lest we grow too fond of it." Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Evan Thomas, Newsweek editor-at-large and the author of the new book, The War Lovers, Roosevelt, Lodge, Hearst, and the Rush to Empire, 1898. And it's now time for our audience question period, and we have a number of questions, so let's begin. And the question is really so many about Roosevelt and about his love for war. First question is, did your perception of Teddy Roosevelt change over the course of writing your book?
I had a very positive perception of Roosevelt when I began to write the book, and I still have it. I think he was a great president. I think he belongs on Mount Rushmore. He was a brave guy, and not just physically in battle, but as a politician. He stood up to those trusts and tried to break them, not in kind of a wild, quixotic way, but in a sort of careful, clever way, willing to compromise. So he was a great president. I wish we had somebody like him today. But I wrote about an aspect of his character that was less appealing. This kind of terrible need he had, it made him do a lot of brave things, but there was something a little bit twisted about it. I mean, this scene of him leaving his family at the age of 39, when he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy. He had a responsible war job, but he just had to go. His friends warned him against it. Henry Cabot Lodge, his great friend, they thought he was nuts, and they were quite cutting about him in their private correspondence. They thought that their friend had gone mad and was behaving in a kind of reckless and irresponsible fashion. I must say that Roosevelt's letters in this period are not blustering and vainglorious. It's interesting. He said, you know, "I've been talking about war for a long time." I read you those letters in which he talks about starting in 1886. Every time this America's even close to a conflict, he's publicly saying, "We got to go, we got to go." He felt that he was on the record calling for war, and he felt that he'd be a blowhard not to go himself, that he'd be a hypocrite, that he'd be a phony, that he'd be a chicken hawk if he didn't go himself. And that argument, which he stated fairly calmly in his letters to his friends, did have some resonance with me. It's made him sound a little bit less crazy. He was lucky, you know, a lot of people did die of disease. He had to scramble to get on that, to get his troops on the boat. He was lucky, and he so found every opportunity to get to the front. In fact, his troop was supposed to be behind a backup division. They were volunteers. They were supposed to follow the regulars. When the regulars were pinned down at the bottom of the hill, he led his men through the regulars, telling them to sort of get out of the way, boys, and led the attack. The only man on a horse. He was a huge target. He was nicked three times by bullets. His glasses were shot off. He kept extras sewn into his hat band. And was lucky as hell to survive. But he did survive. And the gods were watching down on him, and the rest is history.
Please tell us a bit about how William Randolph Hearst affected Roosevelt and how he influenced the war policy.
Well, it's interesting. The two have a lot in common. They are larger-than-life figures. They were both huge war lovers. But Roosevelt did not like Hearst. In the argot of the day, Roosevelt said that Hearst was not a gentleman, thought he was too much of a sort of a shady character, too much of a hustler. Roosevelt spent a lot of time talking. It's not that Roosevelt didn't like the press. Roosevelt surrounded himself with the reporters and was his own best PR man And they didn't have the word embedded back in 1898, but Roosevelt made sure to embed the best and most famous and most colorful writing reporter of them all, Richard Harding Davis, by his side. So he liked reporters, but he thought that Hearst was a bit of a scam artist. They had tangled in New York City, where Roosevelt was the police commissioner, and Roosevelt made a point of enforcing the blue laws, which meant that the no beer on Sunday, which inflamed the large working class populations, Hearst, to sell newspapers partly, and also because he had a genuinely democratic spirit, was a friend of the working man and was always fighting with Roosevelt and accusing him of being a blue nose and a snob, and how could he cut off the beer that the working men enjoyed on Sundays, which helped Hearst sell some more newspapers, but of course did not endear him to Roosevelt. Interestingly, Hearst envied Roosevelt, wanted to be like him. He himself, Hearst, proposed raising a cowboy regiment. It didn't quite happen. And then he went to Washington and offered to buy a small navy and lead it himself. The Navy kind of cocked an eye and gave him a commission as an ensign, which arrived after the war was over. So Hearst writes quite a morose letter after the war is over. He's having a depression. Sometimes these extraordinary figures have these high highs, and then they have low lows. I mean, I think clinically, Churchill was probably manic depressive, and so was Lincoln. I mean, they write about their great highs and their black dogs. And Hearst was in that category, and he writes these almost pathetic letters after, and he's clearly envious of Roosevelt, who's had all the glory riding up the hill, and he knows that Roosevelt's going to get all the credit, and sure enough, Roosevelt runs for governor, and Hearst does his best to defeat him. His newspapers are really vicious in opposition to Roosevelt in the gubernatorial election of 1898, and then Hearst tries to become a politician, actually is elected to Congress, runs for governor of New York, and he is savaged by Roosevelt, who sends out his lawyer to point out Hearst's various lies and distortions. So they had a very, I would say, poor relationship, and yet they really had a lot in common. I guess that's not so uncommon. People who are more similar than they wish to believe, rivals, and end up falling out, but swimming in the same general direction.
What are the most important lessons about war that you believe Teddy Roosevelt, Hearst, and people of that era teach us? Which lessons apply today?
Well, I'd like to think that we learned some lessons from them, but I think that we don't. People ask me, what's the lesson of this book? It's sort of an obvious lesson, don't get into wars without thinking twice, but I think it's a lesson that we never learn. I think the point of my book really is not so much some moral lesson that we should think twice about going to war, although, of course, I wish we would. I think it's rather how hardwired war is in our system. I mean, it's just innate, particularly young men who feel this need to challenge themselves. It's just been true in all peoples, all cultures, in all times, this need to expose yourself to danger, to prove your manhood, in your youth. That's common. I've had interesting conversations with people whether that instinct can be bled out of a people or a time. Europe is an interesting test case. I would say young men in Europe these days are not too eager to fight in wars, but it took World War I and World War II to beat it out of the European culture. I mean, Europe had been arguably the most warlike place of all for millennia. But finally, they had two fantastic cataclysms, and possibly this warlike spirit has been reduced over there. I don't know for how long or forever. There are interesting examples. My wife, Osi, and I, my best editor, I should say, is sitting right here, went to Japan a few years ago to write a book called Sea of Thunder about a naval battle in World War II. And I was interested in the Japanese side of things, so I went to Japan to talk to veterans of the Imperial Japanese Navy, of which there were a few. There were actually a number. The Japanese, unless they didn't smoke or get killed by the Americans in 1945, they lived forever. So we kept meeting with these aged Japanese veterans. And it was fascinating how they were able to hold contradictory ideas in their head. We went to the Naval Academy at Ajima. And the young cadets there are told, war is bad. In fact, they're not allowed to call it a navy anymore. It's the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force. It's not a navy, because navy is a militaristic, warlike word. On the other hand, these young cadets sitting there are required to go to their museum, which is full of rooms with letters home from Iwo Jima graduates, kamikaze pilots, to their parents the night before they died. And the overwhelming message is the glory of sacrificing yourself for your country. So these young midshipmen, these young Japanese midshipmen, have two completely contradictory ideas in their head. War is bad, but sacrificing yourself for your country is the highest calling of all. And they just live with this kind of uneasy, I don't know, it's a kind of equipoise, I suppose. It would drive me nuts, but it's there. It was visible to us in the questions. When we talked to these young midshipmen, you could feel the tension. And sometimes Asians have an ability, a better ability than we do, to carry these contradictory ideas, but they do. So I guess it's a long way of saying I think this instinct is always there, even in countries that have suffered greatly and are, for now, peaceful. Japan, you know, nuked twice. Anti-militarism is in their constitution, and yet I don't think it's entirely gone away.
Interesting. Last week, Victor David Hansen spoke here at the Commonwealth Club, and he said that American psyche is such that we will always be thinking about or be engaged in war. Do you agree?
Yes, I know his work. Victor Davis Hansen is a very interesting character. He's a farmer who's a classic scholar, not far from here, I believe, and teaches nearby. And he wrote a wonderful book called An Autumn of War, or An Autumn at War, right after 9/11, which I found very powerful, talking about the Greek experience, that the Greeks understood that, yes, you may be fated and doomed and things maybe are going to go badly for you, but it is your duty to fight against tyranny. And that was an important lesson for us after 9/11, that even though we were shaken by it and on our heels and, oh, my God, what are we going to do? His message was the timeless message: you can't give in to despair and defeat. You have to be willing to fight for freedom and fight against your enemies. And he wrote just a beautiful book about this. He was discovered by Dick Cheney, who had him to the vice president's mansion and talked to him at great length and wanted to hear about the ancient Greeks. And I don't know how Hansen feels about this, but Cheney unquestionably used Hansen as a bit of inspiration to give him heart and courage, if you will, in the months after 9/11, and to embolden him to fight, to be tough.
Speaking of Vice President Cheney, early on in your book and your enthusiasm, you said, for the war in 2003, you were very pro-Cheney, but you appeared to be, at the end of your book, somewhat critical. Could you comment?
I was a hawk on Iraq, certainly in the winter of 2003. By about 2006, I was questioning my judgment as the war was going badly. I should now say that I think the war has been a mixed bag, as so many wars are. It has cost us an all. If I was related to or the parent of one of those young men or women who died there, I might really be against that war. I have a more mixed feeling because we have created a semi-functional democracy in Iraq. It's a lot better than it was under Saddam. So I don't think, as wars go, it was a pointless war, and although 4,000 people is an awful lot of people to die, unfortunately, in the great death toll tally of war, it's not a huge number compared to a lot of other wars. So I have mixed feelings about it. However, my feelings about Cheney, I think he did get swept away. I used to spend a lot of time with Scooter Libby. I used to go speak to Scooter Libby, who was his chief of staff, on a semi-regular basis, and they would give me these briefings that scared the living hell out of me about biological warfare. And so I think they were sincere. A lot of people think that Cheney was a cynic, or the people around Bush were cynical, and that they were just leading us into war because they kind of felt like it, and they were lying. I don't think they were lying. I think they really, truly believed there were weapons of mass destruction. I say that because I got the briefings that were convinced me that this is all very real. It wasn't. There were no weapons of mass destruction, but I don't think that they were making that stuff up. But I do think they got swept away. I think they did get a dose of war fever. I think they lived too much in isolation. They were only talking to each other. or to Victor Davis Hanson. They didn't reach out as much as they should have, and I don't think that was so great. I think any culture of secrecy and insularity, and when you feel that you know best and you don't reach out, is a dangerous culture. And the culture around Cheney, he had his own staff. He didn't need anybody else. Libby was a great chief of staff, but in a way almost too good a chief of staff because he was self-contained. It's as if Libby didn't need to talk to anybody else. I think that was unfortunate.
Question here. What is it that makes some detest war and some love war? What is it in our society that would affect and make somebody a war lover? And was Vice President Cheney a war lover?
Well, Cheney's a funny case because he never fought in a war. Interestingly, the person who was the most against the war initially in the U.S. government in 1898 was the President of the United States, William McKinley. Why? Because McKinley had been in the Civil War. He'd been at Antietam, Antietam is the single largest loss of American life in any one day. I think that's right. It's 4,000 or 5,000 men. Anyways, McKinley had been there, and as McKinley put it to Roosevelt, arguing with Roosevelt, I have seen the dead stacked up at Antietam. So he had no rush to go to war. He'd seen war. Sometimes people have actually seen war are not in such a hurry to fight it. And the ones that who haven't seen it are perhaps a little bit more willing to send young men into it. You know, there's this cruel expression, chicken hawk, and it's a mean word, but it has, like all mean words, there's a point to that biting word, that sometimes men in authority are a little bit too willing to sacrifice young men when they themselves haven't seen it.
We've really transitioned, I think, to the modern times, and it says, do you think that the modern press has acted as cheerleaders for war, as Herbst did?
Yeah. This is an important question, I think, and a difficult question for me, personally. I noticed that in the offices of Newsweek and amongst my peers in the press in the winter of 2003, an interesting phenomenon. Most of us were Vietnam-era generation. I graduated from college in 1973. My draft number was 365. I didn't get anywhere near Vietnam, which was already winding down at that time. And I was in that generation that marched against the war, protested against the war, considered ourselves to be anti-war. And that was typical of my peers amongst editors at large news organizations. But I noticed that in the winter of 2003, there was a little thrill of anticipation about the war coming up. Even people who said they were against the war, there was this little charge of anticipation, of expectation, of excitement about a war. Why is that? Well, there are a number of reasons. As I said earlier, journalists, I was talking about Hearst, journalists love conflict. Our main, people always talk about the bias of journalists, you know, left or right. The principal bias of journalists is not left or right. It's for conflict, because that's where stories come from. Well, what is the biggest conflict? War is the biggest conflict. So there is a journalistic bias for war. It might be unconscious. It might be unstated. Journalists themselves might be embarrassed about it, but it's there. And I felt it that winter of 2003. I felt it in myself, and I felt it in my peers. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book. I was interested in that. I wanted to explore that. I wanted to understand that better. Where is that feeling coming from, that slightly atavistic and often unacknowledged feeling coming from?
I think you call that the pull of war.
The pull of war, yeah. You know, there are all sorts of ways to talk about this. And to plug somebody else's book, Sebastian Younger has a new book coming out called War. And he's a journalist or a writer who spent 6 months embedded with a group of Marines, I believe it is, up in Afghanistan. And he writes beautifully about this question of what makes war appealing and attractive. I have a conversation with him that is on the Newsweek website that is a very interesting conversation, because we got to talking about this, and they suffered terribly, these young men up there in this awful valley. I'm forgetting the name of it. Do you remember by any chance the name of it? This is the most remote. We just left this. This is a valley we just withdrew from. But there were firefights every single day. It was very dangerous. It was a very scary place. And yet when the men left it, they missed it. They missed the bond they had, the dependency on each other, this feeling that they were willing to die for each other. It was hard for them to go back to civilian life after having this extraordinary feeling of bonding and brotherhood. And even when they were home safe, they wanted to go back to this totally unsafe, dangerous, dirty, filthy world from which they came. And he writes beautifully about this. Clinically, in a way, he writes about what fear does to the human body as you go into combat from a clinical point of view. He discusses the emotions of fear. It's a beautiful book. It just came out. I can't believe I'm selling somebody else's book here, but I am. It's a terrific book.
If we could transition to the future of the print media, and there's a question here that deals with Newsweek and the future of Newsweek.
Sure. Newsweek is for sale. This is a sad story to me personally. Newsweek is a 75-year-old news magazine that until about 2 years ago made a lot of money, but has been hit by these structural changes that are in the media today. The old model is broken down. Now that information is free on the Internet, that's a pretty hard thing to fight against. When information is, when news is free, it's pretty tough for these old mainstream organizations that charge for it and, more to the point, charge advertisers to reach audiences. And we have lost a lot of money in the last 2 years. So the Washington Post Company, which has been a wonderful owner for Newsweek all through this period, and I can say this personally because the Graham family has stood by me through all sorts of messy situations, and I really honor Don Graham, who's our owner. But I understand, and it's, as he said, it's a business. It's not a charity. They can't go around losing $20 million a year. And so we're for sale. So if any of you know any billionaires who want to buy a news magazine, 212-445-4000 is our number. We're actually being represented by Allen and Company, which is a fancy merger and acquisition place, a deal maker. And we're seeking a buyer. I hope we find one, because Newsweek still has some life in us. The business model may not work, but I think the pages of Newsweek still have a vitality and a worth and a thoughtfulness and a consideration that you don't always find online or in a lot of journals. It's still a valuable news organization. It has a great editor, John Meacham, who a lot of you probably have seen on TV. It has our international editor, Fareed Zakaria, is the best, I think, commentator on the international scene there is anywhere. Those are pretty strong assets for any organization, and it would be sad if that organization went away.
Just to remind our listening audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Evan Thomas, Newsweek editor-at-large and historian, who's discussing America's unique mindset when it comes to war, as well as other issues dominating the current political landscape. Our next question deals with the political climate in this country. Does it parallel those days during other wars or major wars of this country? Is this the most divisive time?
Actually, I think that we're kind of war-weary now. I'm noticing you can track attitudes towards war through the movies. In 1968, John Wayne made a movie called The Green Berets, and it was kind of the high point of the last gasp of this glorification of war. Then there were basically no movies at all for a decade. We were sick of Vietnam, and it was such a traumatic experience. We just wanted to come home and forget about it. When the movies did start up again, they were kind of grim, downer movies. What was that Jane Fonda, John Voight, Coming Home, where the hero was some poor guy who's been paralyzed, and the brave Marine loses the girl and walks into the sea. The Deer Hunter at this time, similarly grim thing. And then they're still making grim movies in the 80s. Platoon's pretty grim, you know, Bad Massacre, Firebase Overrun. But I noticed that the worm started to turn in about 1994 with Forrest Gump. I'm sure a lot of you have seen that movie. And I was sitting in a movie theater with my wife and really did a double take, because in that movie they have an anti-war demonstration. And the bad guys are the scruffy anti-war demonstrators. The good guy is Forrest Gump in his clean uniform standing erect. He gets the girl. And I said, ooh, something has changed here in our national consciousness. Protest against Vietnam, my generation, that's out. Being proud of your soldiers, that's in. And I think that continued for a time. I was then again struck in December 2000, one after 9/11, sitting in a movie theater in Washington, again with my wife, and noticing we went to Black Hawk Down. Well, Black Hawk Down is supposed to be an anti-war movie because it's about a disaster, a raid that failed, a Delta Force guy dragged through the streets, the United States is out of there after that, but that's a pro-war movie. Why? Because it celebrates this bond of young men that I was speaking about earlier. That movie ends with the young men walking into the fog together, and you can feel the audience want to stand up and cheer for them. Even though it was a military disaster, it celebrated these virtues of courage and brotherhood and kind of eternal American qualities that make our military great. It was a tremendous pro-war movie, and you could feel then this kind of surge in our adrenaline after 9/11. We were going to show the world, don't mess with the United States. That we, you know, you come after us, we're going to come after you. And I could feel that in my bones, and I could see it on the screen. And so Hollywood's always been an indicator. Now, what's happening now? More subtle and sophisticated movies. The Hurt Locker, which I think is just a gorgeous, beautiful movie, which is not pro-war, it's not anti-war. It just tries to understand war. The motivations of this squad, particularly this one bomb-diffusing expert, how much as he misses it when he's not in the thick of it. But it's not glorifying war, and it has no political statement. It's kind of it's as if so much has happened, we can kind of step back and try to ask ourselves, well, what really is going on here? How can we try to be objective about this? Can we try to really explore what really is without making a lot of political judgments about it? And I think the beauty of The War Lover is it's neither anti-war nor pro-war. It's just true. And there's a new book called Matterhorn, written by this is a book that took 30 years to write, a Yale Rhodes Scholar who went into, I can't remember if it was the Army or Marines.
Marines,
a Marine, of course, a Marine, who was in a lot of firefights and took 30 years to write a novel. It took him that long to get it straight. And maybe because we're so often these pendulums swing back and forth, we're pro-war, we're anti-war, finally he'd get to the point in his life and in our time when we're ready to read about war in a more neutral and if you can ever be neutral about such a thing as war, but at least a more dispassionate way. And this book, I think, is going to be a big bestseller and is a terrific book. So I think we're, in a way, in literature and movies, at a good time now when we can sort of calm down and try to look at this thing that drives us.
Now, just a plug for that. You know, normally that's a novel, and we don't see the Commonwealth Club do novels, usually they're nonfiction, right, George? You know, so we might have him come talk on that book, by the way. It'd be the first.
You should. I think it's only thinly disguised fiction. I mean, I think it's his story.
Yeah, historical novel. You mentioned that you were pro-Iraq and switched in 2006, and now you've more balanced. What's your sensing on Afghanistan? Then, when we began in 2001, in the middle and now?
Well, I wish I knew. I went to Afghanistan in September and spent some time with General McChrystal, who's our commanding general over there. And they were just wrestling with this question at that time. McChrystal had just written this report recommending that Washington send another 30, 40, 50, 60,000 troops. He gave him a range of options. Obama ended up sending about 40,000. And he convinced me that miserable as it is over there, with all the attendant problems, you can't really do it in a half-assed way. That if this region, this swath of largely Pashtun-populated area in southern Afghanistan and northern Pakistan, if there is a jihadist fervor that just sweeps that, and if the United States goes home and they can declare victory, you know, we drove out the great Satan and pick up a big head of steam there, that really puts the government of Pakistan at risk. And, you know, the government of Pakistan has at least 40 nuclear weapons. The idea of them being in the hands of jihadists is just something that if you're president of the United States, it's just a risk you don't want to take. So I understood the logic of trying to not allow that happen, not allow that jihadist fire to break out in such a way that it overthrew the government of Pakistan and gave those weapons to those people. Having said that, they were all scratching their heads there at Kabul because We've learned a ton. You know, the American military has this interesting capacity for growth and for learning. The sort of facile way of putting it is, in World War II, we had to screw up in Africa so that we could do okay in Italy, so that we could win in Europe. And in Iraq, we had to do not so well. We had to learn counterinsurgency slowly and painfully, but we did learn it. General Petraeus and really the young officers there, sort of on-the-job training, figuring it out as they go along, learned how to fight a successful counterinsurgency in Iraq. We've taken those principles to Afghanistan, and I was tremendously impressed with the people around McChrystal, all of whom were combat veterans who've had this experience in Iraq and know how to fight these wars. And they are very good about important things like not killing civilians, not using too much firepower, even taking risks with their men in order not to kill civilians, because the civilians have got to be on your side. I think they've learned all those lessons. I think they execute them brilliantly. But, and it's a huge but, a big piece of counterinsurgency is what they call governance. The locals have got to believe in the government that you're supporting so that they won't believe in the insurgents. They won't believe in the Taliban. They won't believe in the jihadists. Making the locals believe in the government of President Karzai is tough, because the president of government Karzai, you know, the guy's brother is an acknowledged drug dealer, and there's a lot of corruption. And I could see the American military kind of scratching their heads saying, you know, we have a lot of these pieces in place. We feel we have to do it, but we got this governance problem. We're not sure we can trust Karzai, and more important, we're not sure that we can make the Afghan people believe in their own government. That is a real riddle, which I don't think has been successfully resolved. The war is not out of control. It's not, you know, I thought there was a chance by this spring there'd be a lot of dead Americans and the country would be kind of getting stirred up about it in Congress. That really hasn't happened. I think it's been, you know, I think, again, because we've learned these lessons pretty well, you know, when we took over this town recently, we let them know we were coming. We sort of changed the rules of how we do all this. Instead of barging in by surprise at 4 a.m., we said, hey, we're coming in a week. And so we've learned ways to reduce casualties and do this effectively. But there's still this unanswered question about whether the Afghans can govern themselves and train a police force and a military that's capable of protecting themselves and do it in the next year or so, because we want to start getting out of there. The president has said we're getting out starting next year. So, you know, I think everybody's holding their breath a little bit, and I think it's some level it's just unknowable.
In Afghanistan, Karzai is actually coming to the United States, I think, imminently. What advice would you give President Obama to say to Karzai?
I love journalists get to give advice to presidents. I'm not going to give him any advice. I bet what he's going to do is try to cut that fine line between being respectful and frank, but not condoning corruption, and saying, you know, we're not there forever. We want to help you, and we want to build your institutions, and we want to build your courts and your police and your army, and we want to give you economic aid and, you know, help you with your poppy problem. But we're not a permanent occupier, and if you don't clean up your corruption, your people aren't going to believe in you. I'm sure there are all sorts of polite ways that the president will seek to deliver that message.
The patience of the American public for Afghanistan, if the president has set the time limit, has he set a time limit?
Well, he said we're going to start getting out in 2011. He's a little fuzzy about just how fast and what that means, and necessarily fuzzy. You'd be fuzzy too if you were president, because you can't set deadlines for a couple of reasons. One is it's very hard to anticipate events. The other is if you set deadlines, the enemy just has to sit around and outwait you. They just sit back up there in the hills until you leave, and then they come in and take charge. So they're being intentionally vague and properly vague.
Well, you're in Washington and you live in Washington, you see the environment. Question here, what's the role, do you think, for the future of the Tea Party?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, there's some positive things about the Tea Party. Populist movements can serve to draw people's attention to things that the public's angry about, and that's not a bad thing. That's been all through our history. We've had these populist movements. that when there's mass disaffection with government or Wall Street or whatever, these populist movements come up. It happened in 1896, the period which that I was writing about. William Jennings Bryan, running for president as a Democrat, he's got all the farmers and the little folks on his side, and they don't win, but they draw attention to things. So in that sense, I think the Tea Party is useful and positive. Where I part company with them is here. They want to have less government, which is fine. I think probably we ought to have less government. They like to cut spending. I'm all for that too. But they don't want to cut Medicare, and they don't want to cut Social Security. You can't have it both ways. You can't have less government unless you cut those entitlement programs. And my favorite Tea Party line is you tell the government to get its hands off my Medicare. It's a government program. Unless the Tea Party resolves this contradiction, it's hard for me to take them that seriously, although I think that, you know, this is a democracy, and if the people are unhappy, they deserve to be heard, and they have a reason to be unhappy about profligate government spending too much and not, you know, our deficits out of control, and somebody ought to be raising hell about that, and that's fine. But you got to do it, ultimately, you got to do it in a responsible way that brings down the deficit, and this is not rocket science. You're going to have to bring down our deficit. We're going to have to cut entitlement programs. We're going to have to raise taxes, and we can argue about how we do all that, but both of those things are going to have to happen. I mean, the statistic that always sticks in my mind is that for a number of years, when you talk about taxes coming in, about 20% of GDP comes in as taxes every year. By 2020, 25% is going out in spending. That gap between the fifth that's coming in and the quarter that's going out is too big a gap. We cannot sustain that. And there are three ways we're going to fix this. One, raise taxes. Two, cut entitlement programs. And here's number three, which really scares me, inflation. We're going to print money because politicians don't like to raise taxes and they don't like to cut entitlement programs. So the easy way out is just to print money. That's the worst thing that could happen to us, a massive inflation. How many of you remember 1978, 79, 80, 81, 16% mortgages? The country was at its low ebb of national confidence, not because of the Iran hostage crisis. There's interesting poll data on that, although that was bad, but because of inflation. It really sapped our national will and really hurt us. That's not an era that I want to go back to. But if you're not going to do inflation, you're going to have to do these other things, politically painful though they may be.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest tonight is Evan Thomas, Newsweek editor-at-large and historian, who's discussing America's unique mindset when it comes to war, as well as other issues dominating the political landscape. Let's get back to war. Does it seem like the press is ignoring the war in Afghanistan? We're not getting much coverage.
That's true. I mean, the press only covers things when things are going wrong. And the war's not really going wrong now in any kind of visible sense, partly because, as I said earlier, it's being reasonably well fought by the soldiers that are there right now, soldiers and Marines that are there right now. It's hard to say. These things come and go. They come and the journalists travel in packs, and they go here, and then they go there. Right now, they're not doing Afghanistan. They're doing tea parties, and they're doing, you know, oil spills in the Gulf. But Afghanistan is not going away. It'll be back, especially if these governance issues aren't resolved. Because we got to get out of there. And how are we going to get out unless we can deal with these problems? So I wish I could say that Afghanistan has truly gone away. I doubt it. I think we'll be paying a lot of attention to it as the months go by.
Has it become truly Obama's war?
Well, every president has to live with the fact that when you're the one ordering the troops into war, it's your war. We can argue about whether that's fair, but that's the reality. So every president, if you want to be president of the United States, you have to accept the responsibility, and I think they do. You know, when George Bush used to talk about going to see wounded soldiers and Marines, I think that was a real thing for him and a really difficult, painful thing for him. I don't think that was a PR thing. If one thing, he did it pretty quietly. I think presidents really take these decisions seriously. And I'm highly critical of politicians, but I have great feeling for a president who has to send men and women into war?
Sometimes they call on their cabinet, and in the run-up to the Iraq War, the ultimate spokesman for the Iraq War was General Colin Powell. Do you believe General Colin Powell was believing what he was saying to the United Nations?
I've talked to Colin Powell about that, and I absolutely do believe he believed it. As I recall, he was being briefed. He was being prepared for this testimony before the United Nations by a team of CIA people and people from Vice President Cheney's office. And Cheney's office put together a kind of a script for him. And over the course of 2 days, they weeded out the less believable items from this script. So they did some paring and weeding to take out the stuff that Powell didn't think was really nailed down. But he was convinced by the other evidence. Now, it turned out to be bogus. The most famously bogus thing was this idea that the Iraqis had biological weapons labs. That turned out to come from a source whose code name was Screwball. Curveball. Came from a source known as Curveball, who was a thoroughly unreliable source who was then discredited. But Colin Powell had no way of knowing that. You can question whether the CIA should have known it, and as they did their postmortems, I think there was a feeling that they should have been. You know how bureaucracies work. There was tremendous pressure on the intelligence services to come up with the goods to show, as the head of the CIA, George Tenet, said, it's a slam dunk on WMD. A lot of pressure on the analysts at the CIA to come up with the evidence to prove that. And so they were a little bit too quick to believe, or too willing to believe, the curveballs of the world, and they put some bad evidence in that folder that gets passed to Colin Powell. I know that he's deeply chagrined because it made him look like a fool in history to have given a fallacious argument to the world, however convincing he was about it. I feel sorry for him. I mean, he was. I think in his own view, he was trying to be discerning and critical, and as I said, he did weed out about half of the script. It's just that the other half was also phony, or not all of it. Critical pieces of it were untrue.
We're at the point where we're going to have our last question, and I, as a journalist, what was your biggest takeaway after doing all the research and writing a book, that a lesson that should be applied today?
Well, as I said earlier, it's. I wish the lesson was that governments and democracies think twice about going to war. Some wars you really have to fight, others are optional. But I think that this is a bit of a gloomy takeaway. I think that men are men. I suppose the question is, if women ran the show, would it be any different? Sometimes I think that's true, but then I think about Elizabeth I, Margaret Thatcher, Golda Meir. I mean, women could be great war fighters too, so maybe it's just part of the human condition.
Okay, thank you, sir. Our thanks to Evan Thomas, Newsweek editor-at-large and author of the new book, The War Lovers, Roosevelt, Lodge, Hearst, and the Rush to Empire, 1898. We also thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet. Tonight's program has been held in association with the Marines Memorial. I'm Major General Mike Myatt, and this meeting of Commonwealth Club is now adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.